We are back. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom. David, how are you doing?
Not too bad, brother. How about yourself?
I'm doing very, very well today because we are joined by the author of one of my favorite books of this year. The title of it is the St. Louis Commune of 1877, Communism is the Heartland. Author Mark Kruger, thank you so much for joining us, Mark.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Like I said, this is I'm a Great Plains boy myself. So this sort of history that I think, you know, we as leftists get into a lot of European history and stuff like that, but we don't often understand how this stuff was playing out domestically. And your book is a great encapsulation of that. So just give us, before we go into sort of the origins of the St. Louis Commune, give us the sort of overview of this, of how like superlative this event was. Marxists in charge of St. Louis, right? It's have the general strike. Like, this is an amazing thing that I think is submerged a little bit by history.
Well, through the years, I'd read some labor history, and they always had a small paragraph or a few sentences about, and in St. Louis, workers took control of the city, you know, and I thought, well, that's interesting. Why haven't I seen more about that, you know? Mm-hmm. So what happened, why it's important, I think, is that the St. Louis Commune represented the first general strike in American history. And not many people know that, where all the workers in the city went out on strike, shut the city down, and actually took over the city. Also, it was the only time in American history where a communist party ruled a city. And both of those happened. So that in and of itself, I think, is important. But the other things about the commune are that this was a very racist period in American history, the 1870s, right after the Civil War. And in the St. Louis strike, all these workers came together, foreigners, Germans, Irish, French, Bohemian, and blacks and whites all came together to cooperate in that strike. And that was very unusual for the time. In addition, it brought to American workers European socialism, that it wasn't really a part of the American working class at the time. And when the Working Men's Party, which was a Marxist party, took over the city of St. Louis, that really introduced Marxist socialism to the Midwest, certainly, and to the United States generally.
Yeah, so let's back up then to the Paris Commune. And, you know, Marx writes, the specter of communism was haunting Europe. Give us a sense of, you know, how the degree to which it was haunting America, too. And particularly, like, I'm interested in the utopian socialism as well, how that played into. Give us a little bit of the how of the. Well, first, maybe you should define for folks the Paris Commune and then how it was playing out for folks here in the States.
Well, in 1871, Louis Bonaparte decided to attack Prussia, and he did. And the war was over in about a month, and he was taken prisoner in Sedan when the Prussians beat the French, and that ended the Second Empire in France and created the Second Republic. And what happened was that the people of Paris were just disgusted with the way the French had caved in to the Prussians. And the Prussians made him pay a large amount of money for the cost of the war. They made him cede Alsace and Lorraine to Prussia. And the people of Paris refused to go along with it. So they held out, and they were attacked then by the Prussians. And the French government, they set up the Paris Commune, and that was the government of the workers in the city of Paris. And they set out a number of things to do. And one of them was to create social legislation to help the poor, to have secular education, women's rights, and local autonomy, and that sort of thing. Well, when they did that, the government of France moved out of Paris and moved to Versailles. And the workers took over the city of Paris, established the Paris Commune, and ran the city for about 3 months before the French forces gathered together again and attacked, massacring really the Parisians. So the Paris Commune was a big story among working class people at the time, because it was really the first time workers had taken control of a major city and tried to set up a workers' government, a socialist government. So that was the Paris Commune. It was made up of anarchists, of Marxists, socialists, communists, liberals. All kinds of people were in the leadership of the organization, and they had a compromise with each other. You know, some of them believed in revolutionary cells that should be secret and set about making a revolution in France. Others didn't, and there were anarchists that didn't want to get into politics at all. They just wanted to set up economic entities. So you had all these people trying to come together and make a government, and they succeeded in doing that until they were crushed by the forces of the French army. So when news of that got out, the media was largely located in Versailles. There weren't a whole lot of them in Paris, and they told the story of the Paris Commune from the viewpoint of the French government. And in the United States, it was a real scare story. It was these crazy communists had taken over the city. There was bloodshed all over the place, which there actually wasn't when the French communards took control of the city. There was hardly any violence in the city at all. The violence came when the French government took it back. And it was estimated that they had killed 30,000 to 100,000 Parisians when they took back the city of Paris. But the information coming to the United States was that these crazy workers, communists, had taken over. They were taking away the property of the rich people. And it was anarchy. It was total anarchy. And it was something to be very afraid of. And by the time of the St. Louis Commune, that was only 6 years later. So you can see that that was still in the minds of the rich when the St. Louis Commune came to be. With the utopian socialists, you know, they had been in the United States for a long time, started in Europe, in France, actually. And these were people that were pretty much reacting to the industrialization of Europe. And they rebelled against the materialism, the mechanization, and they wanted to set up little communities where they could live their lives without exploiting each other with wage labor and having a democracy that they could control, and no kings, no people to oppress them. And they set those up, and there were a number of them in the United States. I mean, the United States was full of these little communities. You had the Icarians in Nauvoo, Illinois. They also had a community in St. Louis. The Oneida community in upstate New York, the Amanda community in Iowa, the Harmonists in Pennsylvania, New Harmony in Indiana. I mean, they were all over the place. Even Thoreau had said that there was hardly a person walking around that didn't have a plan for a community in his pocket. You know, so there were all traditional communities that were being set up all over the country, and they were socialist in nature. So that they were really the first socialists in the United States.
Yeah, Nathaniel Hawthorne in The Blithedale Romance makes fun of one of these communities that was influenced by Fourier. And it was interesting because that's where I first came across Charles Fourier, a French, I believe, utopian socialist.
Right.
And to see that his ideas were very active in this, in inspiring folks, was very interesting.
There were Fourier communities everywhere. I mean, everybody, even Horace Greeley was believed in Fourier's communities. So Fourier was probably the most successful of all of them. You're right.
And talk about the German immigration to America and how that sort of brought these ideas.
Well, the Germans had come as early as the colonies, but there was a big German movement in the 1830s. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them settled in Missouri. And some of the Germans that settled there actually went back to Germany, wrote books and pamphlets saying that Missouri was just like Germany. There were all kinds of Germans there. There were, well, not mountains, but hills. And you could grow wine there, and people spoke German, and so on and so forth. And so in the 1830s, a lot of Germans moved to the United States and also to St. Louis. But the big influx that affected the St. Louis commune came after the 1848 revolutions in Europe, especially the one in Germany in 1848, because the revolution failed and these revolutionaries had to leave the country. And so many of them came to the United States. And one of them that came to St. Louis was a guy named Joseph Weidemeyer, and he was a Marxist, a friend of Karl Marx and Frederick Engels. And he was trying to decide where to settle in the United States. And Engels told him, don't go to Philadelphia. It's too parochial. Go to St. Louis. There's a big German community. You'll feel at home there.
Hmm.
German culture, German language, that sort of thing. So a lot of the German revolutionaries after 1848 came to St. Louis, and they were very anti-slavery. They fought in the Civil War on for the Union. A number of them were generals in the Union Army, and they ended up leading really the St. Louis Commune and the Working Men's Party of the United States, which took control of the strike in 1877.
And how large was the population in St. Louis of more like German speaking peoples at the time of the commune?
In 1877, 7% of the people were born in another country, and a third of the people were born in Germany. So St. Louis at that time, it was the fourth city in the country. It's only gone downhill since then, but it was the fourth largest city in the country. There was even a meeting with the idea of moving the nation's capital to St. Louis. The city was growing so quickly, and it was a strong manufacturing city. It served by trade. It served eastern cities with western products, and it also served the west and the south with the Mississippi River and people stopping in St. Louis on their way west. So it was a very successful city at that time, and it was very heavily immigrant and very heavily German.
Yeah, you mentioned the Civil War context to this, and that's one of the things I find so fascinating. As a Bismarck, North Dakota native, we had Custer arrive alongside Thomas Lafayette Rosser, a Confederate general, and they were putting the Northern Pacific through the Northern Plains and, you know, ultimately turning the guns of the Civil War onto Native American folks. And you mentioned that there's a similar dynamic here where you have certain members, you have a Federalist and Confederate unity to strike some of these crushes. But maybe before we get to that, let's talk about the post-Civil War economic context that is leading up to this a little bit.
Well, the Civil War is largely a fight between Southern aristocrats, feudal aristocrats, and Northern capitalists. The North is beginning to develop capitalism. The South is stuck in this slave society, of feudalism. And the South had controlled the federal government up until the Civil War, until Lincoln was elected. So when Lincoln's elected, the South kind of sees the writing on the wall that they're going to lose control, and they begin seceding from the Union. So the South, after the Civil War, is totally decimated. The slave society becomes a sharecropping society. The slaves are taking over the plantations, at least during Reconstruction. But in the North is where the really important things are happening. And corporations are being formed, and capitalism is expanding at breakneck speed in the North, especially railroads. And with corporations, the idea behind the corporations was that in the beginning, you could form a corporation with state support if it was for a beneficial purpose, like you needed a bridge someplace. So it was good for the community, so they allowed you to form a corporation, pull your money, not be responsible as far as being sued, and it was encouraged. But then corporations expanded, and the whole idea of a corporation was to make money for its shareholders. That was its sole purpose for existing. And it didn't care, you know, what effect it had on the community, on the people that worked for it, whatever. Profit was the most important thing. And so these corporations then were growing at breakneck speed. They were expanding especially the railroads. So you have the Pennsylvania Railroad, which was one of the largest corporations in the world at the time, the New York Central, the Baltimore and Ohio, all these railroads going west, making a whole lot of money, taking land from the Indians for their railroads. It was important for them if they wanted to establish communities along the line to clear the Indians out. And so you get that everything coming together as a result of this corporatization of American society. And the large corporations are really taking over. And so you have, for example, in the Grant administration, all these scandals with the large corporations. Ultimately, that's going to result in the strike of 1877 by railroad workers and then other workers and the St. Louis Commune.
And in the lead up to 1877, what were the sort of labor organizing? We already talked on, and you can mention a little bit more about the Marxist influence. You also talk about co-ops in your book and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. The unions really came after industrialization. And so as a result, as artisans and skilled workers began to die off, factories arose. And so you had, for example, an artisan making his product from beginning to end and taking pride in his work and controlling his working environment. It was either in his home or in the workplace where he had control of it. And then as capital is invested, capitalists are opening larger factories, and they have machinery, and then we've got steam power and machinery, and now you can make these products in a factory, and you can do it with machines, which makes it faster and cheaper, and these artisans are being put out of work. And so what they end up doing is having to go to work in the factories as wage laborers. Now they don't control their product anymore. They don't control the working conditions. They work for wages, which are totally out of their control. And you have then the beginnings of some unions where they try to organize in order to protect themselves. But by the 1830s, there's unions, but they're very weak. And they're usually in skilled trades. So you don't have like the CIO where you have all workers in an industry joining the union. They're mostly for the skilled people. In the railroad industry, you have the engineers union, the brakemen's union. The engineers get paid more. They think they're better than the others and so on and so forth. So you have these early unions, but they're not very strong and they don't really unite all the workers.
Mm-hmm.
As the years go on, they get stronger. But even then, in the 1840s, you have a big strike of textile workers in Rhode Island, women workers, and where they had nine-year-olds working in the factory 16 hours a day, women working 16 hours a day. And they have a big strike in 1840. And then by the end of the Civil War, you've got the National Labor Union is founded in 1866, the Knights of Labor in 1869, the Grangers in 1867. So you get these big unions. And the National Labor Union and the Knights of Labor are very, very progressive unions. They a lot of unions at the time wouldn't admit black people as members. And there were separate unions for black people. But the Knights of Labor and the National Labor Union went after and tried to enlist blacks into their union, and women also, two groups that had been left out of the early unions. So the unions are getting stronger and broader and more mature by the 1870s. The cooperatives were a part of the labor movement where workers tried to set up their own businesses in certain industries where they could work the businesses without exploiting each other. They were sort of nonprofit. There were producers' cooperatives where they would make the make the items, produce the items, and there were consumer cooperatives where you could buy things without somebody making a profit. And so, as a result, that was also a big part of the labor movement, where workers tried to set up these things where they could work in these cooperatives and not be exploited. They could buy at these cooperatives and not be exploited. And a group called the Sovereigns of Industry was very big in trying to set those up. There were hundreds of cooperatives all over the country and all kinds of different businesses.
So let's talk about the I guess what brought off the general strike first in 1877. Basically, like, was it my, I guess my reading is of your work is stresses on the rail workers getting more, I mean, obviously a very dangerous job. How does this bubble up?
Right. If I can go back just a little bit and bring in all the factors that I think came together at one time to create the St. Louis Commune. The 1848 revolutions in Europe and those people, radicals and revolutionaries coming to the United States and in St. Louis in particular, because one of the things I always wondered was, why does this general strike and a communist party taking over the city occur in St. Louis? Why not in Chicago? Why not in New York? Why St. Louis? And so one of the reasons is all of these German revolutionaries and French revolutionaries that came to St. Louis after the 1848 revolutions, and also the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so that you get Czechs, Bohemians, also in St. Louis as part of the commune. So you've got that that occurs. Then the Paris Commune is an example to these workers of what could be, that they could set up a community and run it without exploiting each other. In 1864, Karl Marx organizes the first international, the International Working Men's Association in London. And the idea is to unite workers across national lines, internationally. And so the headquarters is in London, but in 1872, he moves the headquarters to New York City. And he does that because he's afraid that the anarchists in Europe are going to try to take over the organization. So he moves it to New York. Then in 1873, after this expansion of capitalism, there's a horrible depression, big depression in 1873. And it goes on and on and on. Millions of people are out of work. They're riding the rails. They're walking from town to town. A lot of unemployed people. And the railroad companies, which were the richest corporations and the strongest, in order to maximize their profits, they use the depression as an excuse to cut wages. And the Pennsylvania Railroad and the New York Central, New York Central is owned by Vanderbilt, they cut wages three times in a 12-month period. Mm-hmm. So that workers are making half as much as they were making before the pay cuts. And they weren't getting rich before the pay cuts. But after the pay cuts, they couldn't live on what they were making. And so the railroad industry is going to explode. And so the depression, the railroad industry, all these things come together in St. Louis in 1877. The strike begins in Martinsburg, West Virginia in July of 1877. It starts at the same time pretty much in Baltimore. And then it moves west, workers along the railroad lines from town to town hear about what happened 30 miles away. Then they begin to go out on strike and it begins moving west. And in less than a week, it reaches East St. Louis, Illinois, which was the big railroad center for St. Louis, right on the other side of the Mississippi River from the city of St. Louis. And on July 21st, railroad workers in East St. Louis vote to support the strike. And 400 workers from St. Louis ferry across the river to East St. Louis to join them. And, of course, the strike then moves to St. Louis also. So in less than a week, it had moved all the way to St. Louis, and it continues going west all the way to San Francisco. So you've got a massive railroad strike across the country. Now, St. Louis was a little bit different in the sense that in Baltimore, Chicago, and Pittsburgh, the railroad strike was extremely violent. In St. Louis, there was very little violence. But in St. Louis, it became a general strike where it hadn't in those other cities. And the Working Men's Party, which was formed in 1876. The First International had been moved to New York in 1872. By 1876, they closed it down. But they formed the Working Men's Party of the United States, a Marxist political party. And there were about 1,000 members of that party in St. Louis in 1877. And a lot of these people were active in the First International. They were communists. And mm-hmm. so the Working Men's Party takes over the strike, the railroad strike in St. Louis, enlarges it to a general strike, closes the whole city down. Nothing is coming in or going out of the city. There's not one business that's operating. And this Communist Party is running the city. So all of those factors come together in one place to create the St. Louis Commune.
And I mean, I want to hear a bit more about like the way that they were running the city after, you know, creating the commune there and all of that. But, you know, I also just wanted to note too, that like what's interesting about like the role of the communists there is that, you know, folks have to remember that during this time, like in the American labor movement, like, you know, the friendship between labor and capital was still like a very, very popular idea and ended up being a popular idea across mm-hmm. American labor organizing, you know, all the way up until like the early, you know, 1900s. I mean, if I recall correctly, I mean, Debs at this point in his life too was a labor and capital friendship person. So it really seems that it took, I don't know, like a understanding that the interests of capital and labor are always going to be at odds with each other. That sort of has to come from that more radical European communist tradition to sort of be able to spur people into saying, okay, well, here's the opening, here's the space, and we're going to take matters into our own hands.
Yeah, the even in the First International, one of the sections in the International was led by a woman, Victoria Woodhull, and she wanted to let capitalists into her section of the International. Because she said, well, they know more about capitalism. So, you know, why not bring them in? A lot of the early socialists did want to see some kind of cooperation. But that I think that didn't apply to the Marxists. You know, Karl Marx did not see labor cooperating with capital. Labor was going to overthrow capital in a violent revolution. And the Working Men's Party was led basically by Marxists. So you get, even though they didn't make a revolution, and I have to say they didn't really try to make a revolution, and that raises the whole question about whether one city within the United States can make itself a little communist island, you know. But they the speeches that were given during the St. Louis Commune were very, very anti-capitalist. Very, very supportive of communism. And they talked in terms of, well, not only communism, but the French Revolution. Heads will roll, they said, you know. Mm. It's time for the people to act, to take control. So they were talking about a violent takeover, if necessary. One of them said he'd rather die in a fight than starve to death. So... the Marxists that led the St. Louis Commune, I think, were willing to, well, at least verbally, were willing to go farther. They didn't want to cooperate with capital, but they didn't do a whole lot to overthrow it either. Mm. Yeah.
Matt, you're muted, so we can't hear you.
Gotcha. Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. So as far as policies and demands, and also, you know, public relations, you know, like you mentioned, they allowed passenger cars through so they didn't, you know, upset the public. But yeah, talk about those sorts of factors.
Well, the railroad strike was a strike of freight. They weren't going to allow any freight to go forward anywhere in the country. And but they realized they didn't want to turn off the general population. So they let passenger cars go through. They didn't want to give the federal government an excuse to put them down. So they allowed the mail to go through. The railroads themselves said, oh, we can't get the mail through because these workers are on strike, trying to get the federal government to intervene. The workers said, look, we'll carry the mail ourselves. They wrote a letter to the president. Or send a telegram to the president, will carry the mail if the railroad companies don't want to do it. They didn't want the federal government to intervene. They didn't want to give them a federal issue to intervene, and they didn't want to inconvenience the general public and turn people against them. There was a letter that I quote in the book that where these the trains were shut down, and the railroad blamed the workers. They told the people, "Well, you're stranded here now, but it's the workers' fault. They're on strike." And the letter, the editor, was written by one of the passengers who said, "You know, the workers took up a collection to pay for hotel rooms for all of us and bought us dinner and tried to make our life easier. And it wasn't them that caused the problem. It was a railroad company themselves." So I think they made an effort not to inconvenience the general public, to get the public on their side. And they largely had the public on their side. And a lot of places tried to bring in militias to put down the strikers. And many of the militias refused to do anything. A lot of them gave their guns to the strikers and left town. They couldn't count on the militias. In the Pittsburgh strike, the militias refused to suppress the Pittsburgh strikers. So they brought in militias from Philadelphia to put down the strike because the local people wouldn't do it. The merchants were donating food to the strikers. Not only workers, but people from the communities were going out and blocking freight trains to keep them from running. So the communities were very much in support of the strikers.
Yeah, that part's really fascinating. The demands, which you mentioned, are like, 8-hour workdays and that sort of stuff versus the hysterical exaggeration and red baiting by the press to basically try to stoke this federal intervention. And you also cite sort of officials saying, look, we'll go impose order and then find a law for it later.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll arrest him now and then we'll try to find some basis for it later on because we know it's illegal, you know. Yeah, I found it very interesting that in the 1870s, the language of the rich people in the state was the same as it was in the 1950s McCarthy period. There was total red baiting. These communists are going to slaughter all of us, kind of thing. Karl Marx had said that. The First International was being blamed for everything that happened in the world. And he said even the Chicago fire was blamed on the First International. And he said it's a wonder that the hurricane that hit, I think it was Bermuda, wasn't blamed on the First International. So they were it was not unlike today where they were just blaming communists for everything.
Yeah.
I mean, those terrible communists giving these people ideas that maybe children shouldn't have to be working in the factory 16 hours a day.
Or to be in school or something, you know? In St. Louis, the big demands were for the 8-hour day and the end of child labor. I mean, those were the two big ones. They also wanted nationalization of the transportation system because the railroad company said they couldn't operate them at a profit. And they said, well, let us operate them. The people who operated at a profit. But the 8-hour day and child labor were the two big issues.
Talk a little bit about the elite, sort of capitalist response. You got Vanderbilt. It was a Gould who said he'll just pay one half of the working class to fight the other.
Yeah. Jay Cook. I could pay half the working class to kill the other half. It was a very, very arrogant attitude. Vanderbilt, the workers tried over and over to meet with Vanderbilt and explain the problems they were having and try to work out a solution, and he refused to meet with them. As a matter of fact, when a committee would come to talk to him, he'd fire the whole committee. Refused to talk to him, and the reason was there was a telegram from I think the federal receiver for railroads in St. Louis, who said that they weren't going to give in an inch, the workers weren't going to be running the company, and that he'd just as soon have the showdown now as later. And I think the idea was that they weren't going to give an inch because they felt that they were stronger than the working class at the time, and that they could get the federal government to intervene on their behalf. So they didn't have to give anything up. They would just as soon have the confrontation and crush the workers at that moment rather than give in to them and have to fight another day.
It's really remarkable seeing, you know, requests for Gatling guns and things like that from local governments and things
like
that.
I know. And remember, like, for example, in St. Louis, there was really no violence. Mm. There was virtually no violence whatsoever by the workers. As a matter of fact, they had workers out patrolling the streets to act as police to protect property, railroad property, as well as people. So there really was no violence in St. Louis, and yet they were bringing in machine guns, federal troops, militias, all of these things over people that were really just on strike.
Yeah.
We've touched on a bit of this, but just to give people, you know, understanding, could you just give us, like, you know, the general timeline of how long this lasted and, you know, how the occupation was sort of like organized, to sort of fill in the roles of, you know, government or, you know, civil society during this period of time?
Well, the strike and the St. Louis Commune didn't last all that long. The St. Louis Commune lasted really only a week. And at the end of that time, what basically happened in St. Louis was railroad workers went on strike. The Workingmen's Party took control of it. They had these massive meetings every night, 20,000 people marching through the streets. They had the speeches by all these different people. They had three different stands, four different stands, one in somebody speaking in German, one speaking in Bohemian, one speaking in French, English. So because a lot of these workers didn't speak English, you know, and so they had about 20,000 people at these meetings, these mass meetings, and then marches through the street, torchlight parades every night. So this goes on for a few days. The whole city is shut down. The city government didn't know what to do, so they didn't do anything. And ultimately, the workers move into City Hall and take over the city, and they begin running the city services. Companies whose workers were on strike, a lot of them had goods that were perishables, and they wanted to do something with them before they rotted. So instead of going to the city, they went to the Workingmen's Party Executive Committee, and they said, you know, can we open up for 4 hours or one day and do this, you know, so this stuff doesn't perish? And they gave them permission to do it. And one place was Belcher Sugar, which was a big, big sugar manufacturing company. And when he got permission to run his factory, the Executive Committee, the Workingmen's Party, sent out 40 workers to accompany him, to protect him, to get his factory running again. And he asked for a big cheer in support of the Workingmen's Party for allowing him to do that. So they were running the city, and they were making the decisions, and they were operating the city. Now, after a few days, the rich people in the city got on the mayor and said, you know, what are you doing? You know, these workers have taken control. They're going to take our businesses. They're going to take our property. And what they did is they started organizing a militia in the city. And the militia was made up of rich people and the people who worked for them. And they forced their employees to join the militias. And one company forces employees to join them, but then deducted their pay for the time they served in the militia because they weren't working for them that day. So they put together these militias. The sheriff then ordered all adult males to report for posse duty on threat of jail if they didn't. And so they brought in arms. They raided gun stores. The federal government sent in arms. The state sent in arms. And ultimately, after about a week, They marched on the headquarters of the Executive Committee of the Workingmen's Party, who were not expecting it and were unprepared for it. And they didn't have any guns. I think they found three guns maybe in the place. But the people marching on the headquarters had artillery. They had a cavalry, and they arrested everybody there, and that was pretty much the end of the St. Louis Commune. So the problem with the Commune was that, and it's a problem that in this country that I think any kind of movement like that is going to have to face, and that is that is violence going to achieve your goal? And, let's say that they had used violence and totally taken over the city of St. Louis. How long before the federal government came in and crushed them the way the French government did to the Paris Commune? You know, mm-hmm. So if violence isn't really the solution for your problems, what is? Well, I would say that organizing on a massive scale and the threat of a general strike and so on would be much more effective. But they weren't armed. One worker said, complaining about the executive committee, said they were a bunch of fools, that if they had taken the armory in town, they could have done it with 50 men, and that would have been that. But instead, the richer people took the armory, and they had federal weapons, and they bought weapons. They had a lot of money to buy weapons. They collected money among themselves and bought thousands of arms, and it was totally one-sided, and the end was not really violent. I mean, they came in, people jumped out of windows, tried to run away. They arrested everybody in the building. Three quarters of the people were, in the wrong place at the wrong time. And some of the people they arrested were reporters for the newspapers. And in East St. Louis, when they did that, they arrested the city marshal, they just swept in and arrested everybody they could find in the building, and that was pretty much the end of it. So it didn't last that long, but it raises an interesting question, because at the time of the St. Louis Commune, the federal government, after the Civil War, it couldn't afford to keep the army intact. I mean, it had a massive army for the Civil War, right? So they couldn't afford to keep it intact. So the army in 1877 only consisted of 15,000 men. And most of those were on the frontier fighting Indians. So the question is, could they have put down the commune with force? So all of these are historical questions that people that don't work honestly for a living can debate for years to come. But it raises interesting questions to talk about anyway.
Yeah. And another thing, you mentioned the how similar the red baiting sounds to like what we'd see over like the past century. Also the race baiting, very similar, like, you're collaborating with black people to help end civilization, that sort of thing. And touch a little bit on that and nativism, as, I imagine a bunch of radical Germans and other folks threatening property might make people, people in power think a little bit more strongly about nativism.
Well, in St. Louis, 60% of the population is born in a foreign country. And we're in a period of extreme nativism with all these immigrants coming in. You've got the know-nothings who hate Catholics, who hate foreigners. And there were riots and violent fights between them and the immigrants when immigrants tried to vote, for example. They hated black people, of course. So you had this Native Americans' suspicion of foreigners that, of course, even occurs today, right? That they come in, they're different than you and I are, and at least for a generation or two, anyway, they're different than we. They speak a different language, they eat different foods, and their culture is different, and they're going to ruin our country, And so you had a lot of that at the time. And St. Louis was a very racist city, as most were at the time. And it was very much divided. The Germans were very, very anti-racist. But, St. Louis was also made up of Southerners who lived there. And they were very racist. And so as a result, when the black people joined the whites, united in the strike, they marched together, they served on the executive committee, blacks did, the newspapers in St. Louis went crazy with these black hordes marching through the streets, you know, and so on and so forth. And, you know, they used the N-word, but they didn't put N dash 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 dash, you know, in the newspaper itself. I mean, they just spelled it out. And they were very, very racist. And they really made an attempt to divide the American workers from the foreigners that came in with this foreign philosophy of socialism and the black people. You know, St. Louis was didn't have a whole lot of black people until the Civil War. And then a lot of people, a lot of blacks escaping the South, moved north along the river from Mississippi especially, and ended up in St. Louis, you know. And that was going to continue even years later. Just the move north, you know, the Carolina blacks ended up in New York, and the Alabama blacks ended up in Detroit, and the Mississippi blacks ended up in St. Louis. You know, you got you went north at the shortest possible route you could find. And for St. Louis, it was people from Mississippi largely. So there was this influx of black people, and there were a lot of Irish, because the Irish potato famine in the late 1840s. Those people moved to the United States and to St. Louis also. The Irish were second to the Germans as far as an immigrant group in St. Louis. And the Irish, whereas the Germans that came to St. Louis were largely educated, the Irish were not. They were more of unskilled workers. And so they were in competition with the blacks moving into the city. So there was a lot of racism between the Irish and the black people. And even religiously, the Lutheran Church in St. Louis was very very conservative and very racist. For example, the Wisconsin Synod of the Lutheran Church was against slavery. The Missouri Synod was in favor of slavery, supported the South. And so you had all of these factors that encouraged racist beliefs and actions in the city at the time. It was a struggle. And they say if it weren't for the Germans, Marx said if it wasn't for the Germans, Missouri would have joined the Confederacy. So it was those anti-slavery Germans in St. Louis. Remember, a third of the population is born in Germany, and most of them, but a good share of them are radicals and revolutionaries. They kept the North in the Union. Kept Missouri in the Union.
So, I mean, just not surprising. I mean, there's a, you know, history here that wasn't successful, obviously, but like, you know, of German abolitionists in Texas who like, it was immediate clash. The problem with them is they were completely outnumbered. But yeah, no, I mean, I believe that for sure. But, in the last couple of minutes, unless you had anything, else you want to jump on, Matt, I wanted to talk about this veiled prophet thing, because it is sort of fascinating, the history. You know, because there is immediately after this radical moment, there is a kind of need from the rich and ruling class in the area to sort of show their power and remind people, you know, who's running the show. I mean, could you talk about the beginning of the Veiled Prophet organization and, yeah, break that down for us?
You know, in the 19th century, the streets were the place. It was a public sphere, and people went into the streets, and they had parades and marches and that kind of stuff. And that was entertainment, and it was, well, you know, you didn't have telephones and email and all that sort of thing. So that was how you got your message across. And during the St. Louis Commune, there were 20,000 workers marching every single night in the city. Even the barbers in St. Louis went on strike, and they had marches behind drum and fife corps, you know, and so on. So all of these people were in the streets during the existence of the St. Louis Commune. Well, when the Commune was suppressed, the rich people in St. Louis, when I say that, it's the rich families, came together, and they held a big martial kind of parade, warlike parade. And they marched all these soldiers and militia people, you know, they marched them through the streets, you know, and so on. To show their victory. Well, a few months later, a letter went out to some of the leading families in St. Louis. When I say the leading families, I mean even the Choteau family, which was one of the original founders of the city back in the early 1700s, fur trader. The letter went out to the leading rich families in the city, asking them to come to a secret meeting. And at the meeting, they created an organization called the Veiled Prophet Organization. And it was for rich people and was very limited to a small number of rich people. And the idea was that they created a world, an exotic kind of world with a king, you know, and a prophet and all that sort of thing, all dressed up. And the idea was they were going to have a parade every year, and they were going to elect a veiled prophet every year. And the identity of the veiled prophet was supposed to be secret. But we know now that the first one was the police chief who suppressed the St. Louis Commune. But every year, it's this really rich person. And so the year after the suppression of the commune, they had a big party and a big parade through the streets. And they had floats because one of them had come from New Orleans and he had friends down there and he bought some floats from them. And they had these big floats and they were the floats were decorated like European royalty, you know. And the Veiled Prophet was wearing a sheet with a white pillowcase over his head. And he was carrying a machete or an axe, you know, dressed up like a Ku Klux Klan person, you know. And their idea was that they were going to have this parade every year to show that the streets did not belong to the people. It belonged to them, that there was a hierarchy in St. Louis and that they were at the top of the hierarchy, not the people that had controlled the streets up till then. And so they had that big, I mean, a big parade that first year. And every year since then, 1878 to the present, every year since then, they have a big Veiled Prophet ball where they introduce their daughters to society, debutantes, you know, and so they can meet other rich people, you know, to marry. And they put on a big parade and have a big party for the masses. And through the years, they've continued that, but they've changed the names. They, at one point, there was some July 4th celebration. Then they renamed it the VP Fair, just like British Petroleum became BP, you know.
Yeah. You don't need to spell it. Yeah, say the whole thing.
Nobody would know that it was British Petroleum because it was such a bad name at that point. So the Veiled Prophet became the VP Fair, you know. And they put on that parade every year since then, and that and nobody in St. Louis. Well, first of all, most people had never heard of the St. Louis Commune, but certainly nobody knew the origins of the VP Fair. That it was meant to show the people of St. Louis that they were nothing. That the rich people were at the top of the hierarchy. That they controlled the city, and most importantly, they controlled the streets. So to this day, now. That's been exposed just recently where, what's that woman's name? I forgot her name.
Ellie Kemper.
Yeah, where, you know, she's criticized for taking part in that, like a 17-year-old girl should know what she's doing when her parents tell her to buy a new dress and have her hair done and come out, you know, that she's supposed to know the whole history of this when nobody else in the city knows the history of it, you know. But that's how well they've hidden it. So that it's like they hired this this firm, you know, to clean up their image, and all of a sudden they're these throwing this great party for all the people of St. Louis, and nobody knows the origins of it was to suppress the working class. It's interesting.
It truly is fascinating. I mean, it's something I feel like Adorno would have a field day with her.
Yeah. It's like a reverse shadow of the commune, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Well, they were much more successful than the commune was.
Yeah, right.
That's the unfortunate truth, right?
Yeah. So,
Lord. I mean, this is such a fascinating history. I mean, I really appreciate you joining us to shed some light on it. People should definitely check out the book. It really breaks down all these dynamics really in depth.
Well, I appreciate your inviting me. The you know, I was just going to write something about the St. Louis Commune and what had happened, and as I got into it, I said, wow, you know, this goes back further, And it, mm-hmm. it went all the way back to Germany, and it went back to Karl Marx, and it went back to the German Revolution and all these German immigrants coming to St. Louis. And so I saw that it was a lot more complicated than it looked originally. And it was a very interesting history that that really nobody knew much about. And it kind of it's one part of the story of American labor and the attempt by workers to create a better life for themselves, you know.
Absolutely.
So, well, thank you, Kruger, for the opportunity.
Yep, the book is The St. Louis Commune of 1877, Communism in the Heartland. Go out and buy it, folks. Thank you so much, Mark.
Hey, thank you, man. Thank you, David.